This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary, sitting in for Neal Conan. Today begins the first Senate confirmation hearing for a Chief Justice nominee in 20 years. The week-long process will focus on the legal views of John Roberts, whom President Bush named last week as his choice to succeed the late Chief Justice William Rehnquist. If confirmed, Judge Roberts, at the age of 50, would become the 17th Chief Justice to take the post and the youngest since the appointment of John Marshall in 1801. This will position him to play a key role in shaping the Supreme Court's rulings for decades to come. Democrats plan to use the hearings to question Roberts on issues such as abortion, civil rights, capital punishment, and judicial activism. Republicans have warned the nominee against responding to what they call litmus test questions. While the stakes are high, some argue that the hearing itself is more show than substance, considering the amount of investigation that has gone into Roberts' background. Others say this is the last chance the people have to hear the views of a man who could shape the legal landscape for generations. Congressional hearings themselves have played a significant role, not just in passing legislation, but in shaping the course of history. The Watergate hearings led to the impeachment of a president. Hearings on the war in Vietnam helped change public opinion toward the unpopular war. Today, we'll talk about this week's hearings and what to look for, and we'll talk about other hearings and what difference they've made, if any. We want to hear from you. What were the most memorable moments in past hearings for you, from Alger Hiss to President Clinton? What do you remember and why? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Here to give us a breakdown of what's to come in the Senate this week is Michael Gerhardt. He's a professor of law at the University of North Carolina and author of The Federal Appointments Process, a Constitutional and Historical Analysis. He joins us from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Perhaps you could fill us in on what has happened so far up on Capitol Hill in the hearings on Judge Roberts.
So far, Democrats and Republicans have been giving their opening statements. We've heard from a number of Republicans, all of whom are essentially counseling Judge Roberts to make himself as small a target as possible and not to answer questions that would essentially open up his nomination to controversy. Democrats are warning Judge Roberts about their questions. They're trying to give him, in a sense, a fair shake and let him know what they're going to ask about, and they're going to be very skeptical about his nomination and want to probe him rather closely about the extent to which he's going to be an activist judge, in their view, seeking to overturn a lot of landmark opinions in constitutional law.
Well, let's hear some tape from the chair and the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. First, here's Republican Senator Arlen Specter in his opening statement today.
I do not intend to ask you whether you were overruled Roe versus Wade. I will ask you whether you think the Constitution has a right of privacy, and I will ask questions about precedents as they bear on Roe versus Wade. I'm very much concerned about what I conceive to be an imbalance in the separation of powers between the Congress and the court. I'm concerned about what I bluntly say is the denigration by the court of congressional authority.
And now let's hear from Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy.
Chief among emerging concerns are whether the Supreme Court will continue its recent efforts to restrict the authority of Congress to pass legislation to protect the people's interests in the environment, in safety, in civil rights, and whether the Supreme Court will effectively check the greatly enhanced presidential power that's been amassed in the last few years.
Interesting that both these men have a common concern. That's the role of Congress. What's that about?
That's about is the fact that the Rehnquist Court has struck down a number of federal laws over the last decade. In fact, over 40. That's more laws than any other prior court has ever struck down in the same period of time. That's been of enormous concern to Congress. Members from both parties are obviously going to ask questions about it. Senator Specter indicates that what he wants to do is get a sense from Judge Roberts about his disdain for Congress. There's a concern among some senators that perhaps the problem on the Supreme Court is that it looks down upon Congress, doesn't think it takes enough time in passing important laws. And Senator Leahy's going to follow a similar line of questioning, But the concern that he might have is more about the extent to which Judge Roberts, who spent his formative years as a lawyer for the executive branch, will defer to the executive branch but not to Congress in areas in which each is making constitutional judgments.
So there's some common ground here between Republicans and Democrats. Where are we going to hear these two men, for instance, differ?
Well, Senator Spector and Leahy probably share more common ground than not, but the differences will emerge with the other senators, the other Republican and Democratic senators. They'll divide rather sharply in areas like abortion, civil rights, environmental law, and particularly church and state.
And who are we going to be hearing from? Who are some of the major players here?
We'll hear, for instance, from Senator Hatch, who's a veteran senator. He's been around in many of the prior Supreme Court hearings of the last few decades. He knows his way around this area a great deal. He's going to be one of the chief champions for Judge Roberts. I'm sure he'll be there to try to protect him, ask him friendly questions. Also on the Republican side, you'll hear a lot from Senator Cornyn, who I think will also be interested in trying to protect Judge Roberts and ask him friendly questions. In fact, he counseled him earlier today not to take the bait in answering specific questions about specific cases. On the Democratic side, besides Senator Leahy, Senator Biden is a veteran, former chair of the committee. He will ask, I think, some very sophisticated questions about Judge Roberts' philosophy. Senator Schumer, I expect, will probably emerge as one of the leading critics of Judge Roberts. He'll ask very searching questions to try and figure out specifically what Judge Roberts believes about the right of privacy and what Judge Roberts' philosophy about precedent is. In other words, to what extent is Judge Roberts going to defer to prior precedent from earlier courts?
Interesting that you've said a couple of times that Republicans on the committee are counseling Judge Roberts not to be too open in his answers to certain kinds of questions. Just historically, in terms of these kinds of confirmation hearings, how much do we learn about a nominee? How closely do they hold their views to the vest?
Generally speaking, nominees try to make themselves as small targets as possible. Their objective in the hearings is to essentially not disclose very much. But if they've done a lot beforehand, if they have a relatively substantial record in which they've taken positions, then they are forced to defend that record or at least to explain it. So a lot depends on how much we knew about the nominee before the hearings. With Judge Roberts, much of what we've known about him is based on his experience in the executive department. He'll likely distance himself from that record, saying he produced it working for other people. Democrats will say that's the record that explains why President Bush is so excited about him.
Yeah. Do you expect any surprises in this hearing?
There certainly will be surprises. My guess is that what will happen to some extent is that Judge Roberts may prove to be a little more candid than Republicans would have liked for him to be, and Democrats might be a little bit pleased with that. But at the same time, Judge Roberts will prove to be a superb oral advocate. I mean, he is one of the nation's best oral advocates, and he's prepared for these hearings. If there are surprises, they might actually be produced less by his answers than by the senators disclosing to what extent they're going to support or oppose him and the grounds on which they're likely to support or oppose him.
Why do you expect that Judge Roberts will be more candid than perhaps Republicans want him to be?
I think the Republicans probably want him, of course, not to disclose anything about what he'd do in the areas of the right to privacy, the extent to which Congress could regulate the environment or the economy, and the extent to which the court ought to defer to public displays of religion. But I think Judge Roberts, it's my guess, will probably feel to some extent that he can't always evade the questions, that he can't always give noncommittal answers, and that in some respects he's going to have to explain his philosophy of judicial modesty. He says that that's his philosophy. He believes in this notion of judicial modesty, which I construe to mean that judges ought to be humble about their power and be careful in how they use it. Democrats, of course, will want to unpack that notion. They'll be concerned about that. And at some point, he's got to unpack it. At some point, he's got to explain exactly what that means because, after all, he'll be Chief Justice, if confirmed, for perhaps longer than anybody in history has been Chief Justice. This is President Bush's gift, so to speak, to our grandchildren. And so that's what's at stake here. And what's going to happen then, I think, for Democrats is they're going to keep pummeling Judge Roberts with questions about what does it mean to be judicially modest and what happens when you confront an opinion that's not modest in your view. Do you overrule it? Do you accept it? What do you do with it?
All right, let's take a call now from Brad. He's in Palo Alto, California. Go ahead, Brad.
I'm doing fine. I just pulled over. I call. Is that okay?
Brad?
Okay.
Hi, thanks. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead. Brad, go ahead. Do you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, I do. it seems that Justice Souter, for instance, has been sort of a disappointment to the right, but he was kind of an unknown, whereas Justice Kennedy had a fairly long record, and yet he's also moderated and changed his views somewhat from when he was originally appointed, you know, before he was justice. And I'm curious from the speaker, your guest on the program, if he can talk a little bit about the history of judges sort of going in the opposite direction of where the appointment was thought to go.
All right. Thanks for your question, Brad. I'm going to ask him to answer that as briefly as you can.
Okay.
We have a short time left, but if you can give us a little history there, it'd be great.
I think the essential thing is I would actually disagree with Brad. I don't think Justices Souter and Kennedy actually changed or evolved as justices. I think, in fact, that's a mistaken notion that's sometimes perpetuated about those justices. They essentially were pretty candid in their hearings about their views. They spoke at some length about their willingness to accept a right of privacy, their willingness to accept what are called unenumerated fundamental rights that are not spelled out specifically as such in the Constitution. And I think Justices Souter and Kennedy also acknowledged their willingness to defer to precedent. And that's why the questions in these hearings become so important, because we might well learn a good deal about Judge Roberts. And what we learn is likely to be what we're going to learn is the extent to which he'll follow this notion of judicial modesty. We'll likely learn everything we need to know about Judge Roberts and the extent to which he's going to probably perform his duties over the next 3 or 4 decades.
So even if there's no fireworks, we should be listening closely to this, because we'll learn a lot about this guy, is what you're saying.
Right. The big question in these hearings is, who's John Roberts, and why are people either supporting or opposing him? And you need to watch, of course, the grounds on which people are willing to support or oppose him.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Michael Gerhardt.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Gerhardt is professor of law at the University of North Carolina and author of The Pressure of Precedent and the Federal Appointments Process, a Constitutional and Historical Analysis. He joined us from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. We'll continue our discussion about congressional hearings when we return. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're joined now by presidential scholar Alvin Felsenberg. He says congressional hearings are essential to the democratic process and have helped change the course of history many times. He joins us now in Studio 3A. Thanks so much for being with us.
Honored to be here, Lynn. Nice to see you.
Also here in the studio is NPR's political editor Ken Rudin. He also writes the Political Junkie column, and the latest of his columns is up on NPR.org. Thanks for being with us,
Hi,
Ken.
Hi, Lynn.
Let me start with you, Mr. Felsenberg. You know, some say hear the word congressional hearing, and their eyes sort of glaze over, and they think it. Other people think it's just all rhetoric. It's just all show. Why should we really care about them?
Well, sometimes it is all that, but very often hearings educate the public on an important policy. You think of some of the great bills that passed in the last century, whether they be the GI Bill, the Marshall Plan, the Civil Rights Bill, Taft-Hartley Law. All of them came out of a very long hearing process where the public was educated and engaged. Sometimes legislators like to have hearings to hold presidents accountable, to hold agencies accountable, to see that money that Congress appropriated is adequately spent. Sometimes, and you asked for some great moments in the past, sometimes they hold a hearing just to dramatize an issue. I remember as a tourist coming to Washington one day when the word AIDS first came into the English language, and one of the senators got the idea to invite Ms. Elizabeth Taylor, who was very active in the issue, to come testify. Nobody remembers the things she said. Everybody remembers the lines around the building to get a chance to see her. Mm-hmm. The women cared about the jewelry. The men cared about the beauty. The point is they had their first major appropriation to fight that terrible scourge after she spoke. So hearings have many, many purposes. I'm not even sure a law came out of that, but money certainly did, and it got on the national conscience. So hearings are here to stay, and they perform a number of functions in our history.
Sometimes hearings really do galvanize the public, though. I mean, people are riveted,
yes.
Even those who are not political junkies like you, Ken Rudin. What does it take to have that level of interest in a congressional hearing?
Well, obviously, you need a very controversial figure. We saw that with Joe McCarthy in 1954, the Army McCarthy hearings that were televised live. Joe McCarthy basically had his way with his communist so-called witch hunts, and then it was the attorney Joseph Welch who stood up to him and basically said, you know, have you no sense of shame and sense of Decency, 1954. McCarthy, the basically McCarthyism, or Joe McCarthy as we knew him, ended right there. Richard Nixon won 49 states in 1972. A year later, we see Howard Baker standing up at the Senate Watergate Committee saying, what did the president know? When did he know? And basically, what brought down President Nixon was those daily the hearings in the Senate by Sam Ervin and the House of the following year in the Rodino hearings. So there are a bunch of those in the course of history that have taken national figures and have changed the public perception of them.
Ken, you mentioned the Army McCarthy hearings and that famous moment. We have a clip of tape of that. We're going to hear Joseph Welch. He was the lawyer defending the U.S. Army. And McCarthy had just accused a member of Welch's law firm mm-hmm. of being a communist. So what you're going to hear is a heated exchange. And it starts with Joseph Welch.
Senator, may we not drop this? We know he belonged to the Lawyers Guild. And Mr. Cohn nods his head at me. I did you, I think, no personal injury, Mr. Cohn.
No, sir.
I meant to do you no personal injury. And if I did, I beg your pardon. Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency?
Listen, I know this hurts you, Mr. Welch.
I'll say it hurts.
May I say, Mr. Chairman, as a point of personal privilege, I'd like to finish this.
Senator, I think it hurts you too, sir.
I'd like to finish this.
Alvin Felsenberg, describe the effect of that moment on the American public.
Well, it was a bombshell. No one had stood up to McCarthy. He had stood up at an airport in Wheeling, West Virginia, said he had a list of 2,000 members of the government who were active in the Communist Party. No one was charged. No one was indicted. No one was dismissed because of him. There may have been other red scares and red hunts and other things, but no one on that list. Never made the list public. Somebody called his bluff. The young attorney had signed a petition during before World War II. It turned out it was authored by a communist front, and McCarthy was trying to destroy his career. There was also a hidden hand in that. I mean, McCarthy, the Republicans at the time were very happy to let McCarthy talk about 20 years of treason as long as we were talking about Democratic presidents in Yalta. When a five-star general who was the hero of Normandy was president, seeing McCarthy go after the army, that was the beginning of the end. He began to see Republicans pull away from him. As you saw in Watergate, can I go back to Watergate for just 1 minute? We talked a little bit in the past segment about opening statements. Sometimes you learn something from these opening statements. That question that came up, what did the president know and what did we know? That was Howard Baker's opening statement.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes hearings, they're not intended to, but sometimes they do create new stars.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, one of the stars was the chairman of the Watergate hearing. He was a Southern Democrat who had backed Nixon's Southern policies and had backed a lot of the administration's programs. And Sam Ervin came out of that thing the most popular North Carolinian after Andy Griffith and before Michael Jordan. He sat there saying, well, I don't understand what you're saying. I'm just a country lawyer. I don't wear these Brooks Brothers suits. Will you just walk me through this? This man was a Harvard graduate, a Harvard law graduate. He got a fellow named Butterfield to reveal the existence of a presidential taping system just by these kinds of questioning. So you get a bombshell or two. And that's what we remember.
Hold on there. As long as you just mentioned that, we have a clip of tape of that moment as well. We have White House aide Alexander Butterfield, and he's revealing the existence of those White House tapes. Let's hear that clip of tape now.
Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
I was aware of listening devices. Yes, sir.
When were those devices placed in the Oval Office?
Approximately the summer of 1970. I cannot begin to recall the precise date. My guess is that the installation was made between April or May of 1970 and perhaps the end of the summer or early fall 1970.
On whose authority were they installed, Mr. Butterfield?
On the president's authority by way of Mr. Haldeman and Mr. Higbee.
Ken Rudin? Let's talk about that moment.
Goosebumps. It was goosebumps because everybody who watched that said, oh, my goodness, all the conversations that President Nixon may or may not have had about Watergate with Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Dean, everybody else. They must have been recorded. It was very interesting, by the way, that the fellow who asked Butterfield about the tapes was a guy named Fred Thompson, who's sitting two rows behind John Roberts today. He's kind of shepherded Roberts in and around the Senate.
I should apologize to the listeners. I said it was Irvin, but it was indeed Mr. Thompson.
Yeah.
And he's come a long way through hearings. I should point out, so did Richard Nixon. I mean, we remember the Watergate hearings led to his demise, but the famous exchange between Alger Hiss and Whitaker Chambers before something called the House Un-American Activities Committee created Mr. Nixon as a star. Nobody wanted the subcommittee that he was asked to chair. Nobody took Mr. Chambers very seriously. He was attacking Mr. Hiss for basically selling American secrets to the Soviets at the time. Hiss was probably the most erudite spokesman for the establishment, a friend of Adlai Stevenson's, a friend of Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt. He was calling him a communist. Hiss later went to jail for treason and for perjury. And the recent Soviet archives have given some weight to both Chambers and Nixon's charges. Nixon went to his grave convinced that the enemies he made through that hearing produced the seeds of his own demise 30 years later. He said that to his biographers toward the end of his life. So hearings can be the makings and the unmakings of many people.
We're talking about the importance of congressional hearings, and we're listening to some of the dramatic moments from some of the most famous hearings over the years. If you'd like to join our discussion, tell us about some hearings that you found compelling, that you remember watching on TV or listening to on radio. Give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. And we're going to take a call now from Michael, and he's in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi, Michael.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
Hello.
Yes, I'm here. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, hi. We're talking about congressional hearings that we remember.
That's right.
I was, when I was in high school, I was in an accident, and during my convalescence, I was stuck that summer watching television, and what I ended up watching a lot of was the Iran-Contra hearings.
Mm. And what do you remember about it? Do you remember, is there one moment, or just overall, what was your impression? Why was that?
Well, I remember the overall, my overall impression of the hearings, which really served to form my politics that I still do today. And the other thing I really remember about it, though, was that kind of moment of, in all of these events and all the, you know, relatively boring testimony, was that kind of high drama moment of Oliver North, you know, sitting there in his Marine uniform and one of the senators had questioned him about what he'd been doing, and, you know, he comes up with this how dare you, you know, indignation about, you know, who are these people to question him, and this was answered with a, well, how dare you, you know, kind of thing. And it was just kind of like the moment where it's like you sat up and went, huh, whoa.
All right, thanks, Michael. So I think what Michael is describing there, which is interesting, which is sort of a political education, that he got a political education just by watching the Iran-Contra hearings. And let's talk about that a little bit, but also what were the long-lasting effects of the Iran-Contra hearings?
Well, in the short term, not very much. I mean, one could argue that it was a commission that was appointed. John Tower chaired it, that really saved the Reagan presidency. Reagan reorganized the White House. Reagan disavowed Ollie North. Reagan's polls were high, I point out, as President Clinton's were during his impeachment, which came at the end of some hearings. Congress really did not want to end the administration. He was a popular president. He was liked on the Hill, but they had to do some changes. North, I think, got our listeners' attention because he turned it around and basically held the Congress in contempt, and very few witnesses get away with that. And there was a trial subsequently followed, and it was dismissed on a technicality. But very few witnesses, most witnesses come in tremoring. This is not something people want to do.
Yeah.
North turned it into a show, as our listener just reminded us.
Kendra, one thing, we've been talking about some really big congressional hearings there, the star-making hearings, the ones that everybody... What about those day-to-day congressional hearings that nobody but, you know, a couple of reporters sometimes are sitting at? I mean, where does that fit into? What's the importance of those kinds of hearings in terms of the political process?
Well, they're extremely important for political process, but not, you know, for shock value or glamour or any kind of a dramatic moment. I remember that once years ago when I first came to Washington, sitting in the middle of a Henry Gonzalez banking committee hearing, and I made the mistake of I was the only reporter. Every other reporter was sitting at the edge of the chairs, and I was sitting in the middle of the aisle, and somebody told me, you never sit in the middle of the aisle of a Henry Gonzalez banking committee hearing because reporters try to sneak out as quick as they can because it really goes on forever. You know, we just mentioned 2 seconds ago about John Tower. 2 years after the Iran-Contra, John Tower himself was up for Secretary of Defense, President Bush's cabinet, the first President Bush. And what I think was fascinating about that hearing is that he was rejected as Secretary of Defense because they said that he drank too much and he caroused you know, with women too much. And again, many of the senators who voted against him were people who drank too much and caroused with women. So I thought it was a fascinating thing to watch.
Similar jokes were exchanged during the allegations about Senator Thomas, Clarence Thomas.
Let me just remind our listeners that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take another call now from Cheryl in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello there.
Hi, go ahead.
You still hear me?
Yeah.
I'm outside in the wind. I'm remembering the Clarence Thomas hearings with Anita Hill, and I'm very much like your last caller, and that was kind of a political awakening for me, and really has shaped who I am as a woman and as a citizen and how I hear the news. I remember this woman sitting in a room full of men, and she was all of a sudden being accused, and she wasn't the one on trial, and it really has affected me in the way that I hear how much the male-dominated voice has come through.
Interesting, Cheryl. Thanks so much. I'd like our guest to comment because you're the second caller now who's talked about the fact that hearings have really served as a political education for them. So thanks for that call as another example. And Ken Rudin, why don't you talk about
Hill Thomas is one of the more dramatic things because, again, it showed racism, it showed sexism, it showed harassment of women. These are issues that were not on the tip of everybody's tongue. Certainly politically, the caller makes a very, very good point that you had a black man challenged by a black woman in front of a Senate panel of all white men. And so basically, Arlen Specter paid a little price for that. He's still in the Senate, but he criticized Anita Hill pretty dramatically. There was a backlash against him. He came close to losing his seat in 1992. The Senate really changed a lot. 92 ultimately became the year of the woman. Carol Moseley Braun, among others, were elected to the Senate in 92. So those Hill Thomas hearings made a big difference.
A clip of tape from that. Let's just play a clip of this is Clarence Thomas testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1991.
I have been racking my brains and eating my insides out, trying to think of what I could have said or done to Anita Hill to lead her to allege that I was interested in her in more than a professional way, and that I talked with her about pornographic or X-rated films. Contrary to some press reports, I categorically denied all of the allegations and denied that I ever attempted to date Anita Hill when first interviewed by the FBI. I strongly reaffirm that denial.
Yeah, I would say that as the Hiss Chambers case has never been resolved, at least in the minds of advocates of Mr. Hiss and Mr. Chambers, some people who were around during those hearings will go to their graves saying that their side was correct. She's not been proven, he's not been proven or disproven. Let me take you back a generation. Let's talk about our first war baby president, Bill Clinton. His first hearing were the Vietnam hearings, and he was an intern for Senator Fulbright. Now, why were those hearings important? For a solid month after the Tet Offensive, Fulbright offered an alternative view of American foreign policy. We often think of hearings between a president of one party and the Congress of the other. Here was a Democratic president, a Democratic senator, who had worked very closely with Lyndon Johnson, having a different view of the world. He had been turned down by John Kennedy for Secretary of State because they didn't like his segregationist votes on civil rights bills. That's why he was not in Rusk's seat. And he basically took apart every argument Johnson made about light at the end of the tunnel and just 50,000 more were going to win this thing. What those hearings did, they made it respectable to be against the war. You saw stockbrokers walking around with peace buttons on. Before that, they were just a bunch of hippies with long hair.
All right. Thanks to both of you for joining us today, Alvin Felsenberg and Ken Rudin. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.